Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Radio Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso. Today we'll have part two of our candidate forum in the District 4 supervisorial race. Hear their views on energy, sand mines, wildfire prevention, and other East County issues. But first, we'll have some national news stories from Public News Service, including attacks on school curriculums, mental health counselors speaking out on gun violence, and environmental threats to whales off California's coast. Then we'll have some local news stories, including a suspect who threatened to set fire to an El Cajon motel, Santee's City Council eliminating a major traffic roundabout, and the sheriff hosting a catalytic converter engraving event in Santee. Hear about a new effort to recruit young people as firefighters, and finally, on Destination East County, hear about all the fun festivals and events coming up. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for July 24th, 2023. I'm Mary Sherman. With a new school year a little more than a month away, educators remain steadfast in fending off attacks from some parent groups and conservative lawmakers over what's taught in classrooms.
Members of the American Federation of Teachers gathered for professional development sessions, but there were fiery speeches, too, in light of attempts in many states by conservative-linked groups to ban books in certain curriculum. AFT President Randy Weingarten noted these attacks on the public school system are being carried out in the face of decades of trust educators have built in the U.S.
Parents know we have children's best interest at heart. We teach. We help young people learn how to think critically, to discern fact from fiction.
Those who want to see public school systems reined in argue teachers are given too much leeway to handle sensitive topics like race and gender. And while many of the culturally divisive issues affecting schools haven't been as noticeable in Minnesota, controversial groups like Moms for Liberty have a number of local chapters around the state. I'm Mike Moen.
Gun-related deaths among children and teens are growing, and no state is exempt from the impact and effects of this growing epidemic, according to the CDC. Ohio is one of 10 states where gun-related deaths among kids are highest. Kids from impacted communities recently visited the Ohio State House to meet with lawmakers on the issue. Executive Director of the East Cleveland Neighborhood Center, Jake Streeter, says his kids, many of whom come from neighborhoods where regular gun violence is a reality, drew posters and wrote letters with ideas and solutions that are now displayed throughout the State House.
Many of our students have a feeling about gun violence that they believe we as adults aren't taking the situation as seriously or as we could.
According to the Children's Defense Fund, nationwide in 2021, more than 4,700 children and teens were killed with guns, up 40% from 2017. Meanwhile, mental health experts say people with psychiatric conditions are being unfairly scapegoated for America's gun violence epidemic. Catherine Carley reports.
Studies find there's more news coverage of shootings in which there's been an allegation of mental illness, which can perpetuate the falsehood that people with mental health challenges are more prone to violence. Dr. Jack Rozelle with Resolve Crisis Services at the University of Pittsburgh says it's an easy stigma to perpetuate.
The data is pretty clear that in the United States, about half of us live with a psychiatric illness, right? So it's actually quite common to live with a psychiatric illness. It's not those people, it's us together.
Rozelle says research shows about one quarter of public mass shootings are tied to mental illness, but there are often a number of risk factors that lead someone to commit violence.
This is Public News Service. There's good news for orcas off Washington's coast. Two new calves have been spotted among the endangered population. However, births also punctuate the whale's dire situation. We get the story from Eric Tegedoff.
The Center for Whale Research confirmed the birth of two calves in the L pod of the southern resident killer whales, the first additions to the L pod in 2 years. John Rosapepe is the Pacific Northwest representative for the Endangered Species Coalition. He says the whales are still under threat, lacking food primarily because of 4 salmon-blocking dams in eastern Washington.
Removing the dams and restoring the salmon on the lower Snake River is essential in recovering the southern resident killer whale population.
Rosapepe says nearly a dozen southern resident orcas are malnourished, including one pregnant whale. The addition of 2 calves increases the number that frequent the Salish Sea from 73 to 75.
As signs of climate change surface, policymakers and utilities are making a hard change to transition to clean energy sources, but questions remain about whether the power grid will be ready. The U.S. Department of Energy says to meet demand for sources like wind and solar, the nation will need to expand transmission systems by 60% by 2030 and possibly triple them by 2050. Amelia Serling Hennis with Clean Energy Economy Minnesota says the nation's current grid system is old and wasn't designed for the newer approach to powering up cars, homes, and businesses.
As more of us convert to electric vehicles and getting off of our natural gas-powered appliances at home, as we're electrifying things, we're going to need more electricity, and the current system is just not going to cut it.
But Hennis warns completing a new transmission line can take up to a decade and says there should be more urgency in permitting these projects without minimizing public input. The Americans with Disabilities Act marks its 32nd anniversary this week. And in Nevada, the statewide Independent Living Council wants to educate policymakers and the public on how ableism can be damaging to those with disabilities.
The group is working on drafting their official position statement on ableism, which can be thought of as intentional or unintentional discrimination or prejudice against individuals with disabilities that are many times based on negative stereotypes. Dave White Jr. is a recent master's graduate from the University of Nevada, Reno. He says navigating school as a neurodivergent student was challenging due to some ableist assumptions, but not impossible.
One of the better ways to kind of diminish these ableist assumptions is to remind people that we each have our own sort of unique challenges, our own unique abilities, which comes with, you know, the development of our own unique skills.
He encourages those who have disabilities to find people who they can have open lines of communication with and establish agency. I'm Alex Gonzalez reporting.
I'm Mary Sherman for Public News Service, member and listener supported and online. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. A stolen vehicle suspect barricaded himself in an El Cajon motel Thursday evening and threatened to set the building on fire. After spotting a stolen vehicle in the parking lot at the Best Inn and Suites, El Cajon police officers saw the driver entering a motel room on surveillance video. He was identified as 43-year-old Randy Hanks, a felon on probation with an active felony warrant for theft. He was the guest of an occupant of a room paid for by the county's homeless voucher program. Hanks refused to come out at first when police arrived and barricaded the door, held up a can of lighter fluid, and said he was going to light the room on fire if officers entered, according to Lieutenant Darren Forster. A crisis negotiations team began negotiating with Hanks to surrender, while other officers began evacuating surrounding motel rooms. Fortunately, Hanks eventually came out and was arrested for his felony warrant, possession of a stolen vehicle, and possession of stolen property.
Fire management needs to evolve to attract young professionals, according to a new youth-led organization called Fire Generation Collaborative. FireGen's leaders are all college students or recent grads who want to change the way society approaches the field. Co-founder Kyle Trefney says we need to stop seeing fire as the enemy.
We have a strong fear of fire. It's a little bit misguided because fire has been a natural part of our landscapes for thousands of years, and it's been managed in safe and healthy ways traditionally by Indigenous people.
FireGen advocates for more prescribed fires and Indigenous cultural burns to get the benefits of burning while mitigating some of the risks and impacts. Tim Inglesby is an instructor at the University of Oregon who runs the group Firefighters United for Safety and Ecology.
What we really are trying to promote is a paradigm shift in fire management, away from reactive firefighting and more proactive fire management. So we're really working with fire instead of fighting against it constantly.
The group recently traveled to Washington, D.C. to meet with lawmakers and express support for youth advisory councils at federal agencies within the U.S. Forest Service and the Department of the Interior. Last year, the Forest Service said it was short more than 25% of the workforce it needed heading into fire season. And federal data show that wildland firefighters are more than 80% male and 70% white. Ayuthea LaPierre is FireGen's communications director.
So fire generation is focusing on ways to make sure that the fire field, especially in terms of workforce development, has parity and makes sense to have a career in. Oftentimes, careers in fire are very short-lived. They have a large impact on your body. They tend to be really, really exclusionary towards people of marginalized genders.
FireGen calls on community colleges in fire-prone areas to train more young people on best practices for prescribed burns and fire resiliency. This story was produced with original reporting from Colleen Haggerty for Nexus Media News and the site Reasons to Be Cheerful. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Santee's City Council has voted to eliminate a roundabout planned for the Highway 67 off-ramp at Woodside Avenue. The city has spent around $800,000 since 2015 on designing and engineering plans for that roundabout. But last month, during a discussion of the city's capital improvement program, which is essentially a wish list of projects over the next 5 years, at least 3 Santee council members said the roundabout, or traffic circle, wasn't necessary and would likely cause more traffic problems than the current 4-stop configuration. Councilman Rob McNellis said, "I think it's a bad idea. I always have. Stop wasting time, money, and resources on it," he added. Vice Mayor Laura Quaval said, "I think their plan creates more problems for residents than what we have now." The Highway 67 roundabout was proposed by Caltrans, so Councilman Ron Hall suggested that agency should pay for it. So council directed staff to cut the roundabout project from the capital improvement program. The council also eliminated planned median improvements on Mission Gorge Road between Finita Drive and Carlton Hills Boulevard, as well as the city gateway signage project. Reporting for East County Magazine from Santee, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from San Diego's East County.
This is Miriam Raftery with a public service announcement from the San Diego County Sheriff's Department. Catalytic converter thefts of vehicles are on the rise regionally. To help protect motorists from losses and increase the chances of being able to return stolen parts to owners, the San Diego County Sheriff is hosting a free catalytic converter engraving event on Saturday, July 29th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. in Santee. The address is 8891 Railroad Avenue in Santee. Reservations are required for the July 29th event. Your driver's license plate number will be engraved on your vehicle's catalytic converter at the event to help with investigation and potential recovery. All makes and models are welcome. To register, you can call Crime Prevention Specialist Jake Donnan at 619-538-0493. Have your vehicle registration ready when making your reservation.
Would you like to receive East County Magazine's newsletter with top news weekly from our inland region? You can also sign up for free wildfire and emergency alerts. Stay safe and informed. Sign up for our complimentary emailed newsletter and wildfire alerts at eastcountymagazine.org.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, and we are back with part 2 of our candidate forum for the candidates running in the District 4 Supervisorial Special Election. If you missed part 1, you can hear it or actually watch the video on our website at eastcountymagazine.org. So today we have with us 3 of the 4 candidates running. Paul McQuigg was not able to make it. We have Monica Montgomery Stepp, President Pro Tem of the San Diego City Council, small businesswoman Amy Reichart, the founder of Reopen San Diego, and Marine Corps veteran Janessa Goldbeck. Moving on to energy, another huge issue in East County. The county has set a goal, an ambitious goal, of reducing carbon emissions to net zero by 2024. But in May, after a lawsuit was filed over the regional decarbonization plan, the plaintiffs cited research indicating that infill projects such as solar on parking lots and rooftops in the urban areas and on greenfields or brownfields would cost less and produce more power than building industrial scale wind projects and, you know, massive desert solar projects in the back country, which is largely what the original plan called for, because it didn't take into account the energy that's lost in the transmission or the cost of building all of those transmission lines. In May, the supervisors approved a new study on the feasibility of prioritizing infill projects, such as the rooftop and parking lot solar, over industrial-scale wind and solar in the backcountry, which have had a lot of negative environmental consequences people may not be aware of on the wildlife, on the wetlands, quality of life of residents. And we've even had several of these turbines burst into flames and start fires. Thank goodness, never during red flag, you know, conditions. So my question is, do you support the county goal of cutting carbon emissions to address climate change? And secondly, what are your views on the most appropriate way to meet those goals, and particularly with regard to the scale and siting of new green energy projects? Let's see, I believe this one is Amy's turn to lead off.
Thank you. I do support the county's goal of net zero by 2035. In fact, we all attended a climate action social justice forum on Friday night in Hillcrest. Here's where I differ slightly from my fellow candidates, and that is...
Oh, and I forgot, let's say 2 minutes on this. Go ahead.
As we're moving toward these goals, though, there are some things that we also need to take into consideration, and that's people. For example, I live right here in North La Mesa, and they want to put a battery storage facility not too far from homes, in fact, just feet from homes. And that sounds like a good project. It's going to store some of the solar energy and also be able to give us a better source of renewable energy. However, it also produces 75 decibels of noise that's comparable to a freeway. And so when it comes to these kind of projects that also have unintended consequences, causing fires, battery storage units have been known to explode or catch fire right here in the county. In fact, I just think that we should proceed cautiously as well when we're looking for these environmental goals. So as a for example, in the 2021 Regional Transportation Plan, the mileage tax is in Chapter 3. Now, we're still waiting to hear from the 2025 updated version, and we haven't seen if that mileage tax is still in there. And that would be how I would lead. I would want to lead with incentives rather than penalties to move us towards our environmental goals. I'm not in favor of a mileage tax locally or even on the state level that would really hurt working class and marginalized communities the most. So you can absolutely count on me to protect the environment. I would just make sure that we would also want to make sure how it's affecting our working class people too, who are working so hard to stay here in the county.
Thank you, Amy. Janessa, it's your turn.
Sure. Well, I have a long track record and I'm on record in support of solar projects on rooftops and over parking lots. That's where solar belongs, in my opinion. I do think that we have a lot of work to do to meet our clean energy goals. I support the county's goal to decarbonize in the time frame that it's set for itself. And I think that when we think about emissions in this county, what are the largest contributors to greenhouse gases? It's cars on the road. And cars on the road, we have to be realistic about where we live right now. And 95% of San Diegans drive. That's the reality. How do we incentivize people to spend less time on the road? It's by building housing close to transit and providing more clean energy transit to parts of the county that currently don't have it. We obviously need to, we know that the state of California has goals about electric vehicles on the roads. Right now, we need to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. The reality is that people drive and the transit infrastructure doesn't exist for it to make sense for a lot of people right now. We don't have mass transit to our airport, as a great example. There are very few places that work for people, but there are some parts of our transit system that do work really well. The Blue Line, for instance, from San Ysidro into downtown, 17 million people utilize the Blue Line, one of the most effective public transit routes in the nation. And so I'd like to look at taking what we've learned from the Blue Line and expanding that to other parts of the county. Doesn't just have to be fixed rail or trolley. It could also be clean energy electric buses. But thinking through how we can make transit more attractive to more users, that includes making sure it goes places people actually want to go. It includes making sure it's safe and clean and people feel comfortable on it, and making sure that it's actually shaving time and making their day more efficient rather than a burden. And that's really where I'd like to put the bulk of my efforts.
Okay. Thank you, Janessa. Monica, could we hear your views on energy issues and the siting of energy projects?
Yeah, absolutely. I do support the county goals. And also, I know that the decarbonization plan is being challenged on the basis that, you know, it really promotes the larger utility scale projects that do have their impacts on the environment. And I do think that we have to start phasing in more of the microgrid rooftop solar projects to create additional community infrastructure and control over these issues. I think that that's extremely important. But I also think that with regard to microgrids, this is an area that there's a lot of funding that we could receive from the state and federal government that could support small businesses in this area. This is a way to enhance sort of, it's that go-between, you know, those that are putting solar on rooftops and then those that are doing the larger utility scale projects. It really is a middle ground that could be so beneficial for a lot of our community members. So I would love to focus on that and put, you know, kind of shine a brighter light on the possibility around being able to build that type of general generational wealth and with regard to small business and microgrid placement in the area of energy. Big supporter. We have we are now in the last stages of finalizing our plan for a green energy equity complex right in the heart of the city council district, which also happens to be right in the middle of the supervisorial district. This is something that businesses will come to, and also we'll have a partnership with the Unified School District so that young people can be introduced into the industry as well. So I think there's a lot of possibility here, and I'm really looking forward to digging into it more at the county.
Okay, good. Thanks to all of you on that. The Cottonwood Sand Mine is proposed along the Sweetwater River in Rancho San Diego, Middle District 4, just upstream from a federal wildlife preserve and very close to homes, schools, and businesses. There's also been a proposal to sand mine El Monte Valley and Lakeside, right through a county-designated scenic wildlife corridor, and again, close to homes and equestrian businesses. In both areas, the residents, as well as environmentalists, are generally opposed to the projects, although the developers will say that the sand is needed for construction and roadway projects locally. So I would like to know what your priorities would be if these projects come before you in weighing whether or not to approve proposed sand mines in our region. Janessa, you're first on this one.
Yeah, I've heard from a number of residents who live near these proposed projects about how concerned they are, and I think with good reason. I certainly would not want a sand mine going in my backyard, and especially for the unincorporated areas, understanding how challenging it is to get resources to repair their roads. There's a lot of deep concern about the effects of not just the mining operation itself, but trucks, heavy duty trucks transiting through the neighborhoods and over surface roads and the damage they could cause. So Obviously we have a need for construction here in the county. However, we also know that with existing building technology and new technologies, there are additional alternatives to sand, and there are ways to reduce building costs outside of construction materials. One way the county could be very helpful there is by streamlining some of our permitting processes to speed up the process for builders, and also looking at reducing some of our impact fees where it makes sense to do so when we want to build. So I want to think about ways that we can make construction more affordable and cheaper so that we can build homes faster. But I don't want to do that at the expense of our environment or the neighborhood, so to speak, for people who are living right there. I think that would be a very invasive project. And I'm not sure I'm buying the reason why it's important. So that's how I feel about it. Of course, every project is different and we need to evaluate it as things as they come before the board. But that's my general approach, especially given where both of these projects are in relation to open spaces and wildlife corridors.
Very good. Thank you. Monica, let's hear your views on how you would assess whether or not to approve sand mines should they come before you on the supervisors.
Yeah, I'm with the community on this one. I've come out fairly early, especially in opposition to the Cottonwood sand mine. I think that, you know, where this is 2023 and there are many innovative ways to get the material that we need. We all are in agreement that we need to build, but we have to find other ways to do this. And, you know, the East County residents that I have talked to are all against this, no matter how they identify otherwise. There is a consensus that, you know, that folks are tired of feeling like the dumping ground. And then this is another example of that. And so, you know, I definitely stand with the community, and I think it's important, you know, to emphasize that, as we've all, I think, been told by residents, that we will, in this capacity as supervisor, be servicing these communities as council members and or as their mayor, right, for the unincorporated areas. And so it's important to really be vocal about the issues that come from the community. And I definitely have experience in that, in serving as a council member. And some of the issues really line up with some of the disillusionment we have with residents around, you know, having proper representation. And so this is really one of those issues where community members, a very reasonable community members, are saying, no, we do not want this. And then we're looking at also the environmental impact. So, you know, I would be against sand mining. We have to come up with other ways to find and retrieve this material that we need to build.
Thank you. Amy, could we please hear your views on sand mining?
I've spoken with former Supervisor Diane Jacob on this issue. She's been leading the community effort against this sand mine, and I agree with her and the community that this is not an appropriate place in the community, that it's going to have far too many negative impacts on the residents, but also the environment. But also, I've heard from people who say, you know what, we want an affordable place to live. And the fact of the matter is, concrete. And that's what sand is, the main ingredient to make concrete, comes from. So what's happening, as I've spoken to people in this industry, and no, I have not been endorsed by the developers and I'm not beholden to them at all, but I do hear from all stakeholders on these issues. And what they're telling me is, Amy, right now we have to go out of state to get sand. So of course that hurts the environment too. If we have to bring in sand from Arizona, for example, or Nevada. So making San Diego affordable, protecting our environment, protecting communities, and allowing communities to have a voice is essential. So I just want to reiterate that I am against this particular project. I believe that it's better placed, that we can all come together and find a much better location in the county that's not going to hurt the environment or the community, that will also help us build those affordable homes. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Transportation is an important issue. Some of you have touched on this already in your earlier answers, but not everyone. The county has been striving to increase transit ridership, and yet congestion has increased on some highways and surface streets. Rural residents have also voiced concern over a couple of things, a bait and switch sometimes when projects were built and they were promised that, you know, Highway 52 would be finished or the connection of 125 and 94, which is yet unfinished. Rural residents have also voiced concerns over the mileage tax that would be paid for by everyone, even those who live in areas that don't have mass transit. So I would like to ask, how would you juggle those sort of competing priorities of improving transportation, getting people to ride more mass transit, and yet being equitable to all residents, including those who just live too far out to have that access? Monica, I believe you're first on this one.
Yeah, thank you for the question. So the way you handle this is very carefully, because we're dealing with a lot of different things. One is dealing with things that the community has always been already been promised, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think funding for those projects should certainly be prioritized above anything else. And I also just am a firm believer that in order to go, you know, back to the people and ask them for additional money in any capacity, then we have to be trustworthy and efficient with what we've already asked for, right? And so I think just on principle, we have to break the projects down and prioritize them based on what has already been promised and what, you know, may be in the future. Now, all of this, on top of all of this, we have state mandates. You know, we cannot run away from those. Those are there. And oftentimes we have this conversation in a bubble, not kind of making the connection that we are making decisions about things that we have to do, that we are required to do now by state, especially if we want to meet our climate action goals, right? And so that is extremely important. I want to build out mobility hubs wherever we can. And within those mobility hubs, as stated in a bit of the Sandag Five Big Moves plan, we can have shuttle service. We can have what we've talked about a lot in these forums of first and last mile service in those mobility hubs. There are many ways to get there, but the plan, you know, is being built out, and I am committed to that, especially for our rural communities that, again, have been promised these things and haven't yet seen them. So the way that I would handle it and break it out is, what has already been promised and is supposed to be funded? And then what are our future goals moving forward? And then how can we responsibly fund those? Being of course, you know, responsible with what we said we were already going to do.
Thank you. Amy, let's hear from you on transportation priorities and the mileage tax.
So on Friday evening, we all did attend a Climate Action Social Justice Forum. And I decided to ask a question of the audience, and there were 200 people there. And it was so awesome to see so many people passionate about the environment. And the question came about public transportation. So I said, by a show of hands, how many of you took public transportation to this event tonight? Only two out of that entire audience took public transportation to the event. Now, this group of people you would expect would have the most buy-in and would want to ride public transportation. But what we're finding is people are just finding that public transportation is not working for them. I've been around San Diego County long enough. I voted for the Transnet sales tax. I had high hopes that the sales tax would be used by Sandag to improve our roads. I'm a North La Mesa resident. My son actually goes to school in Spring Valley. And so every single morning I have to take that 94-125 interchange. And every morning I feel as if we are taking our lives in our own hands. It is that dangerous and it needs to be improved. And people have been waiting decades for that improvement. And I recently did go out to a community meeting. It was in La Mesa. It was put on by Caltrans about the 94-125 upgrade. So we do need to fulfill those promises. People have paid that money into Sandag to use to upgrade projects such as 94 and 125. Instead, what we've been seeing is the money has been diverted into public transportation and people are just not buying into it. even people you would expect most likely to do so. And the reason being is it just doesn't fit the needs of average San Diegans. So if we're going to take on public transportation, we have to completely reimagine it. I do not want to see a situation like we had with the state of California, where billions and billions and billions have been spent on this bullet train to nowhere. So if money is going to be allocated through SANDEG for public transportation, I do not believe in putting the money into a broken system. I am against a mileage tax on the county level and the state level, and I believe that public transportation needs to be completely reimagined.
Janessa, could we hear your views on transportation, please?
Yeah, I think San Diegans have a right and a reasonable expectation of being pretty distrustful of SANDAG. Many things have been promised, few have been delivered. And there is certainly a healthy skepticism about increasing additional taxes on the backs of working and middle class families. I do not support a vehicle mileage tax either. I think that the chair of the County Board of Supervisors has made it very clear that that's not something that's in the pipeline. And I don't think it will be when it does, when and if it does, that's probably a statewide conversation. And we're going to have to work really closely with our state partners there. But I do believe that there are simple things we can do in the short term to make our transit system more accessible to more people. One thing we could do to reduce time that it takes the trolley to get from stop to stop is by building overpasses over trolley stops so that the trolley doesn't actually have to stop for road intersections. This is a tried and true method that reduces increases the speed of the route, but also it reduces traffic deaths, noise, the trolley doesn't have to blow its horn, et cetera. When it comes to the rural parts of the county, I'd like to really significantly invest in both making sure that the roads are drivable. As Amy mentioned, there's some really rough spots out there. There's funding that has been promised that has not yet materialized, been delivered. I spoke earlier about the success of the Blue Line. I do want to point out that until we put the shovel in the dirt, it took 30 years. So it was a very successful project once shovels hit the dirt, but it took 30 years to get there. So we need to be serious about making investments now. The federal government, there is historic amounts of funding coming from the bipartisan infrastructure law, the Inflation Reduction Act, billions and billions of dollars that are available to the county. I want to make sure our county gets its fair share. I'm proudly endorsed by the majority of our federal delegation, and I would want to work with them and our grant writers at the county to ensure we're going after every single available dollar and putting it to work now, that we're not just waiting for a 30-year plan to materialize, but we're making investments now that help people who are trying to get to work and spend less time in their cars.
I'm going to throw in a couple of lightning round questions since we have a little bit of extra time today. But you mentioned infrastructure. We have a crumbling and very dangerous dam out here out in Lakeside, the El Capitan Dam, and also the Sweetwater Dam. Both of these are old dams where if they were to break, it would be catastrophic. And in the case of the one in Lakeside, it's right by an active earthquake fault. But would each of you commit, we'll just make this 30 seconds, you know, yes or no, if you get an opportunity to speak up to our federal representatives about infrastructure priorities, to ask for some money to get these dangerous dams fixed once and for all? Let's see. I think, Janessa, you would be first on that one.
Is this just a yes or no?
Pretty much. You know, I mean, yeah, okay.
Absolutely. Yeah.
This is more of a making sure everyone's aware of how bad these things are. I should add, they both have the highest capacity potential for loss of life, and they're rated the most dangerous in the worst condition that the state can possibly rate a dam.
This just gets back to my earlier point. Like, San Diego County gets its butt kicked in per capita federal funding by other mm-hmm. counties around the state. We'll have these two dams that are crumbling and extraordinarily dangerous. This should be something that is a priority for the state and for the federal government. And so we need to make sure that we're getting our fair share to address it.
Okay, Monica, how about you?
Yes, absolutely. So certainly we'll advocate for the dams and restoration of them. We at the city of San Diego, we propped up a government affairs office that deals directly with the state and federal government. I've also been endorsed by Congresswoman Sarah Jacobson, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, quite a few state officials as well. And so, yes, this would certainly be something that I bring up in those conversations.
Okay. And Amy?
Yes, absolutely. I do not accept the status quo when I hear elected officials say, oh, well, our hands are tied, or the state mandates this, or the state is making us do that. I will stand up for county residents, and I will advocate for us at the state and the federal level.
Okay. On fire safety, the fire season has really become year-round with climate change and worse fires. They're saying this may be the worst season yet. We've seen fire response really improve in our region. I think that's something they've done generally very, very well. And we're seeing multiple agencies just pouncing on these fires. I would like to ask each of you, will you commit not to cut firefighting resources if the budget gets thin? Will you commit to do everything possible to keep full funding for firefighting out here in East County and all of the unincorporated areas, actually? And the second part of that is, unfortunately, we've seen the sheriff's department get rid of the ability for the public and the press to listen to scanners. That happened in January in response to a law, a state law, that requires that either you have to take stuff off the scanners or you have to put it on a secure channel so that nobody's private information accidentally gets broadcast, which I've never heard happen. But the problem we're seeing now is that while the San Diego police, you know, did the latter so that you can still listen to their scanners, same with Cal Fire, San Diego Sheriff has just taken it completely offline, and they've ignored pleas from the media to put it back on. And what that means is that there's a lot of things that we're not able to alert the public about that are true crises in public safety, like hearing, you know, evacuation warnings live when they're happening, hearing about an escaped prisoner that was running around by Grosse Pointe Hospital. You know, we shouldn't be finding out about that, like, you know, the next day, if at all. We should be able to listen live and hear that. So my two questions are, will you commit not to cut firefighting funding? And two, will you, you know, push the sheriff, maybe holding a hearing on this scanner issue and try to get them to put it back online, you know, put only the secure information on a secure channel like San Diego Police does, keep everything else, make it available again for the press and the public to listen to during emergencies. I've lost track. I think this is Amy's to go first on.
I'm 100% for transparency and openness when it comes to government. So I would support having that those frequencies open to the media, for example, as long as private information is secured and there's no chance of, say, a domestic violence victim's information right. coming out or a crime victim's information. So I just want to say a yeah, but to that. And then last year, I was completely surprised by the San Miguel firefighters. Someone called me on the phone and said, Amy, your face is on Highway 8. And I had no idea what she was talking about. And it turned out the San Miguel firefighters did a billboard for me saying, we support Amy Reichert for supervisor. So firefighters know that they have my back. And I absolutely agree that our firefighters, our first responders absolutely should make enough money to be able to live in our county. And that simply hasn't been the case. So yes, I support more funding for firefighters.
Okay, Janessa, how about you on the fire response funding and the scanner issue?
Yeah, I'm very proud to be endorsed by San Diego County firefighters. And I absolutely understand how stretched thin they are as well. They are also facing a staffing shortage. And that means that with increasing wildfire season basically being all year round and supporting fires in other parts of the state, our folks are always on mandatory overtimes. As a Marine, knowing how deployments are on your family, knowing what it's like to be away from your family and not have a sense of knowing when you're going to be back. I know how stressful and straining that is. It's not just a dollars and cents issue. It's also a morale and mental health issue. So it's absolutely imperative that we give our firefighters the resources they need to be able to recruit and retain the right levels of staffing and that they have the equipment necessary. When it comes to the scanner issue, I've lived in rural areas where the police scanner is your source of news about weather or otherwise. I know how important that can be to folks who live in other parts of our county. And so I agree with Amy. I would want to ensure that, victims' information doesn't make it out into the general public. But it sounds like there's definitely great models and examples out there of ways that you can broadcast information that the public needs to know while also protecting the identities of victims.
Very good. And Monica, your views on the fire funding and wildfire funding and the pushing the sheriff to restore scanner access.
Yeah, I think that the sheriffs should restore scanner access with, you know, the framework that protects everyone who needs to be protected for sure. And if others are doing it, I'm sure that the sheriffs can as well without giving up any of that information. It should be private. So I do support mm-hmm. that. Also support continued funding for our firefighters and in their wildfire efforts. In the previous election, I was endorsed by local 145 San Diego firefighters. And, you know, in 2018, I was not supported by them, but still went in and fought for raises and equipment and everything that they needed. So this is really, you know, not about one person, but our primary job is public safety. Firefighters are a huge part of that. And so I would absolutely support their efforts.
Well, it's time for closing statements. I'm going to give each of you 2 minutes. If you could also include in there a couple of your major endorsements, who's backing you and why you believe you're the best candidate for a job and where people can find more information about you. Janessa, your turn to go first.
Sure. Well, thanks for everyone who's tuned in and watching. Really appreciate you being part of the process. And of course, ballots are in the mail now, so voting has begun. And I'd be honored to earn your vote and your support. I spent 7 years as a combat engineer officer in the Marines. Over the last 15 years, I've worked as a policy advocate to make change at both the federal, state, and the local level. And I'm very proud to bring that experience, to put it to work for my hometown. I think that local government is important. It's powerful, but we're not going to solve our problems on our own. And that's why I'm proud to say I'm endorsed by the majority of our federal delegation, our state delegation, and elected officials and community groups across the region. I'm also, you know, as I mentioned, proudly endorsed by our county firefighters, by the San Diego County Medical Society, Vote Vets, and other groups across the county and the state. The end of the day, the reason that I'm involved in politics and running for elected office is that this is my home. It really matters to me what happens here. I had the experience of taking care of my mom in the last stages of her life as she struggled with MS and Alzheimer's. And I understood how fragile her system of care and her ability to live independently really was. I see so many people around our county who are just one paycheck away or one catastrophic health incident away from winding up on the street. I know that people my age are concerned about their parents who have kids who are struggling with addiction or mental health issues are concerned about them. Our whole community is deeply frightened because we are all living on the brink, on an edge. And I want to make sure that people have the resources they need. The county has the ability to provide in-home supportive services to seniors, to help people stay in their homes, to help people get addiction treatment and counseling. If we really lean in and think big, for too long, we've accepted the status quo. For too long, we've said the county's not really a part of these conversations. It's time to change that. Politics as usual is not working. I've never accepted the status quo. I will get in there and fight, and I'd be honored to earn your support. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much, Janessa Goldbeck. Monica, could we hear your closing statement, please? Monica Montgomery, step.
It's a mouthful, I know. Thank you so much, Marion, for having us here this afternoon. You know, as I'm going through this race, I am continually reminded of my own story. As a 20-year-old, I got very, very sick in Atlanta, Georgia, while I was at Spelman College. I had to come home. My mother had to take care of me. We had to apply for county services. And if the county had not been there for us, I really don't know where I'd be today. But I also saw in that process that there were flaws, that people who are in their most vulnerable state need to be able to apply and have dignity and respect as a human being. And so I am very committed, will bring that additional lens to this seat, in addition to already having served as an elected official, understanding bureaucracies, taking some of the most controversial issues and coming out the other side with unanimous vote and implementation. That's really what we need to tackle the crises that we are in right now. That's what I bring to the table. And I'm very honored just to be able to run and to express that to everyone in East County and throughout this supervisorial district. I have been endorsed by quite a few elected officials at every level of government. I'm proud of them all. I mentioned Congresswoman Sarah Jenkins, Congresswoman Barbara Lee, Secretary of State Shirley Weber, Assemblymember Akilah Weber, Assemblymember David Alvarez, but also Councilmember Jack Shue, Councilmember Patricia Dillard, Councilmember Jennifer Mendoza, Councilmember George Gastel, those who are very, very familiar with the East County and can continue to express those concerns to me. And so this is really a groundbreaking election, a lot of involvement, which I'm grateful for. And I'm just hoping that that proven experience and track record will be the difference for this race. So thank you so much for your time.
Very good, Monica. Thanks so much. Amy Reichardt, we'll let you have the final word here.
Well, hopefully my house isn't too noisy. Kids are home from school, from summer break, and my dog has just decided to start barking. But what I really wanted to share was why I got involved in the past couple of years. And the reason being I got involved is because what I saw were the policies, the failed policies of Nathan Fletcher the past couple of years. No one can deny there's not one measurable metric in the county of San Diego where we are better off than we were just 5 years ago. So I bring my strong business mindset with me as a small businesswoman. Also, my leadership in founding and scaling very quickly a successful nonprofit that saved thousands of workers' jobs right here in the county. And so what I really have a proven track record of is my heart and listening to people from all different sides. That being said, I am the San Diego Republican Party endorsed candidate in this race. I do have the endorsement of two current sitting supervisors, Supervisor Jim Desmond and also Supervisor Joel Anderson. I have the endorsement of former Supervisor Kristen Gaspar. I have the endorsement of two current sitting congressmen, Kevin Kiley, as well as Daryl Issa, as well as five local mayors. And that's really what it's going to take. It's going to take a regional approach to solve the problems that we have here. And I just want to add that I do not believe at the end of the day that government is necessarily the solution to our problems. Many times it's government that's getting in the way and is causing the problems. I believe that if government got out of the way when it comes to housing, we would see more housing being built that is more affordable for local San Diegans. So if anybody wants to reach out to me, my email address is Amy, A-M-Y, at amyforsandiego.com. My website is amyforsandiego.com. I really do respond to emails and I want to hear from you. If you'd like to volunteer in my campaign, well, it's game on right now. As we know, there are 29 days left until the last day to vote, and people will be receiving their ballots in the mail today and tomorrow. So look for those and make sure that everybody votes. It's so important to encourage people to vote.
Thank you all very much. I want to mention that the ballots are being mailed, as you noted, to every registered voter in the district. You can vote by mail. You can vote early at early voting locations. You can vote at the registrar's office. If anyone didn't get a ballot or still wants to register, you can visit sdvote.com. The last day to vote is August 15th, and if no candidate receives a majority, then there will be a runoff election this fall. I want to encourage all of the candidates to think of us as a resource here at East County Magazine. I know not everybody is familiar with rural issues or agricultural issues or some of the things we didn't even touch on, but that you may be asked to vote upon on the supervisors. So think of us as, you know, a resource here to help you as well. I really appreciate our diverse array of candidates taking the time here to join us in our forum to help voters make informed decisions. And I also want to thank everybody watching on our Facebook page. We will be posting, for those who missed it or came in late, the entire video of the forum on our website at eastcountymagazine.org, as well as more information on the candidates, including Paul McQuigg, who was not able to join us here today due to a connectivity problem while he was traveling. So thanks so much, and good luck to all of you in the upcoming election. Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week. This is Miriam Raftery with Destination East County. As late July sizzles into hot August nights, there are some hot happenings coming up across San Diego's inland region. 3 days of family fun are coming up at the Ramona Country Fair, July 28th through 30th. Presented by the Ramona Chamber of Commerce, the fair features amusement rides, carnival games, live music, a cornhole competition, an off-road show, food and beverage vendors, craft and commercial vendors, western shows, and more. The fair is held at the Ramona Outdoor Community Center, and you can get tickets at ramonachamber.com. Pine Valley celebrates Pine Valley Days, July 28th and 29th. The fun starts with a deep pit barbecue Friday night at Pine Valley Park with live music by the Big Sky Moon Band and dancing at the gazebo. Then on Saturday morning, July 29th, the parade starts at 9 a.m. along Old Highway 80 with floats, horses, classic cars, stilt walkers, balloon artists, and more. After the parade is the annual Pine Valley Days event at the park. There you can enjoy live music by bands, bounce houses, delicious food, and shopping. For more info, you can check out pinevalleydays.com. Now, if you need some laughs, Space Bar Cafe and Wine Bistro in La Mesa hosts a comedy night on the fourth Friday each month from 7:30 to 9 p.m. On July 28th, the talent lineup includes Gene Levin, Carol Johnson, Jennifer Mason, Chris Williams, Sarah Lee Steiner, Sapna Iyer, and Ben Yin. For details, you can visit at spacebar.com. Oasis Camel Dairy in Ramona is offering farm tours July 29th from noon to 2 p.m. The tour includes a camel and bird show, feeding camels and miniature sheep, along with other farm attractions and an option to ride a camel. For tickets and reservations, visit cameldairy.com. You're invited to come party with police as El Cajon celebrates the 40th anniversary of its National Night Out event, fostering positive interactions between law enforcement and the community. This year's event, set to be the largest ever, will take place on Tuesday, August 1st from 5 to 9 p.m. in the parking lot at Parkway Plaza. This year's event includes a fitness course where participants can challenge officers and an obstacle course. The event also features a live band, Whiskey Ridge, with country music and line dancing. Athletes from San Diego Wave will be attending with a mini pitch setup. There will also be children's crafts and a kids' arts competition, an auto showcase, and opportunities to meet police, firefighters, paramedics, and representatives from the Sheriff, Humane Society, Highway Patrol, and Border Patrol, plus check out their vehicles and equipment. The Julian Starfest returns August 11th through 13th. This year's festivities include a public star party on Saturday night, August 12th, camping availability for tents and RVs, astronomy games and crafts for kids, exhibits by major telescope and accessory vendors, food and beverage vendors. On Saturday only, there will also be a raffle for donated astronomy equipment, plus an optional behind-the-scenes tour of the world-famous Mount Laguna Observatory. All proceeds are used to help fund the San Diego Astronomy Association's ongoing community educational efforts. Learn more at julianstarfest.com. You're invited to don your cowboy boots and wrangle up the gang for the Mount Helix Food and Wine Tasting Festival on the evening of August 19th. This year's event features a Wild West theme, saloon, live music, and line dancing. Food and wine tasting from local restaurants and beverage companies, as well as artists, live and silent auctions, sunset views from atop Mount Helix, and dancing under the stars. You can get tickets at mounthelixpark.org, and that's mthelixpark.org. Cajon Classic Cruises continue along Main Street in downtown El Cajon. The car shows are held each Wednesday from 5 to 7:30 p.m. all summer long. The city also hosts outdoor concerts in the park on Prescott Promenade and the same area along Main Street each Friday night from 6 to 8 p.m. now through September. Find a full list of weekly car show themes and the lineup of concert bands at downtownelcajon.com. Santee officials say it's music to their ears. The city's summer concerts taking stage for outdoor concerts running each Thursday night from now through August 17th. The City of Lemon Grove invites you to concerts in the park each Thursday evening from 6:30 to 8 at Berry Street Park. Bring a blanket or a lawn chair along with your own picnic or barbecue. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor at eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.